Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, our guest is Stephen Poole. It's a War Stories episode. What's Stephen going to have to say about war stories? Not quite what we thought. It's all coming up next on TWRT. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twrt. And by Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. I'm live in the Telos Alliance studio here in Nashville, Tennessee, with lots of goodies here provided by my friends and my employer at the Telos Alliance. Thanks a lot to them for their help. This is This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. And today is one of our flights of fancy, one of those times where we talk about the fun stuff, the stuff that happens in the trenches, at the transmitter site, interacting with crazy disc jockeys and managers that don't understand much of anything about what we do. And it's our job to relate what we do and relate to you the stories behind it, because it's fun that way. So we do the show every week. So welcome in. Glad you're here and glad you could join us. We're going to introduce our guest in just a couple of minutes. But right now, let's bring in my co-host. He's been here for just about every episode. And that's Chris Tobin in the New York City area. Chris, welcome in. How you doing?
Thanks, Kirk. I'm doing well. Just enjoying a nice cup of coffee in my Museum of Television and Radio mug. So it's good times.
So what's the story on the cap? I don't have one of these.
Well, you know, if you attended a New York City SBE when Broadcasters General Store does hosting, you'd get one of these skull caps. And that's what this is.
Yeah.
BGS. Look very closely.
I see. Oh, I see. It's right there.
Yeah. There you go.
So for those of you,
one of ours. They're sponsors. I said, you know, why not?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll take it off. I know it looks kind of ghetto or maybe, you know, gangster, whatever. That's not me. Okay. Fine. But I just,
you know what?
Just a nod. A physical nod to the folks at BGS, because they are really good people. And I'm not saying that because I've known them for 20 years, but they really do provide a service. And service these days is difficult to come up by in many businesses. So, you know, this is one of the few bastions of broadcast services that you can still get.
Well, at BGS, they are all about service. They've been my friends for years, and man, they hop too when you give them a call.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. The other day, I had somebody say to me about services, and they were talking about Amazon and what we can learn from Amazon. I said, well, Amazon's not the only company that does service very well and pays attention to the customer. You got to talk to the folks at BGS. And my buddy's looking at me like, well, I know those people at BGS. I said, yes, you know them well enough, and you understand that there's no friction, there's no concern, there's no barrier to entry. You didn't even think of them. He's like, oh, you know, you're right. Maybe there is something we can learn from them. So that's the new statement, what we can learn from BGS.
You know, one of the analogies I like between the way Amazon does business, and I know they're not perfect, and you know, some people say they've done some harm in one way or another. But one of the things I really like about Amazon is when you go shopping there, if they owe you money, in other words, if you've got some credit sitting there from an Amazon gift card or a return or whatever it may be, if you've got some money sitting there or some points on your Amex card or your Amazon store card, they let you know about it. In other words, they say, hey, you got money here. Do you want to apply it? And it's just that has always struck me as unusually wonderful. They don't hide that. They don't keep it back. And honestly, it always results in me spending more money, right? Like, oh, I got that free money. Well, I can buy something else now. So it's good psychology. It's good for them. So how can we relate that to our world? Well, you know what? We'll think about that a bit and maybe get our guest to talk about that tool. Let's see if our guest is here, Stephen Poole from Birmingham, Alabama. Stephen, welcome in.
Hello, guys.
Hey, it's good to see you. It's good to see you, Stephen. You're on a phone today coming to us, right?
Yeah, Windows didn't want to. It says the webcam is installed, but the browser couldn't pull it up.
Well, this is just a tiny, this is not a war story. It's just a little battle story, but it seems like we do battle every day with confusers, don't we?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Especially if Windows is involved.
Yeah. Yeah. I use a Mac, and you know what? 99.999% of the time, it does what I think it's going to do, at least. Not perfect, but it does what I think it's going to do. Hey, we're going to get into war stories with Stephen Poole.
And Chris Tobin will have a story for us, and I might come up with one as well. But Stephen, being in Birmingham, Alabama, you know, a lot of us think of Alabama as being a flat southern state. It ain't flat at all in Birmingham. There are mountains and hills around there. And so there's a lot of places to put transmitter sites. There's a lot of forests. There's lots of places for dangerous animals or bad people to hide. I don't know what Stephen's got in mind for us, but it's going to be good because Stephen has been there and done that in the realm of broadcast engineering. Hey, our show this week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by, hey, Suncast, is it Angry Audio? Is that our first ad? I'm sorry, I didn't look. All right. Our show is brought to you in part by Angry Audio. Let's take a look at the gizmo here. We'll take a look at this. You know, studio guests are only human, and humans, well, they cough, they sniff, they clear their throats, even on the air. You can cure this with the Angry Audio Guest Gizmo. Press the cough button. Mute the mic. Every guest needs one of these. You know what else guests needs? Well, they need headphones, which is why each Guest Gizmo also has a studio-quality headphone amp with individual volume control. Anything else? Well, you've seen those mic arms with those built-in LED tallies. They're gorgeous. But how do you light them up? Well, the Guest Gizmo does that too. It illuminates the red light whenever the mic is hot. And installing the Guest Gizmo in your studio furniture could not be easier. All you need is a 2¾-inch hole saw and a steady hand. You don't have to have a router. Your studio gets a clean custom appearance, and you get all the credit. Check out the Guest Gizmo and all the other cool gadgets at angryaudio.com. Angryaudio.com. They do have a lot of cool things there, so check them out. They will help you build your studio right. They can even help you use some less expensive equipment, you know, like one of these inexpensive audio consoles, and give you lots of logic functions for it. Thanks, Angry Audio, for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, Stephen, let's not get too much ado here. Tell us what you do in Birmingham, who you work with, and then we'll jump into some tales of daring do from you.
Well, first, let me say, I wish I had seen that Angry Audio thing before I built a bunch of headphone stations. I'm the chief engineer for Crawford Broadcasting. Can you tell I'm tired? Crawford Broadcasting, Birmingham, Alabama. I've been here for 20 years now. Been having a ball. We have five primary stations here. Of course, we have a few HD multicast. You have to keep up the streams. We also have our some of our IT stuff here, including, most importantly, we have our mail server. Our corporate email is here, and I have to keep that up.
Wow. So,
well,
Steve, you know,
with the help of my assistants, I'm sorry.
When I first became aware of you, it may have been through Telos. It may have been through some articles that you have written in Radio World or maybe Radio Guide. But I came across you thinking, well, he's an IT guy, because you wrote about storage area network or online storage using some Linux product. You've been writing articles for a while for some industry magazines, right?
Yes.
What's been your crowning achievement in something really cool that you've written about? What have you enjoyed most there?
I enjoy teaching. It's hard to come to any one thing. I've also taught electronics in industry to technicians, you know, and I took them off the street. They didn't even know, you know, they didn't know a meter from a coffee cup. And by the end of the course, we had them repairing things. And I don't know. I love explaining things. Sometimes I get a little pedantic and I go back and read it and say, wow, you know, you might have hope I didn't insult anyone's intelligence, but I love teaching. I love teaching. I love explaining. I love sharing things with people when I learn something. Here's one that a lot of people are not aware of. I certainly wasn't. If you have a website, you'd better talk to your web developers and make sure that it's ADA compliant, because apparently the lawyers have discovered that as a new source to go after. I had never thought of that. And see, your server is in Denver, but I help maintain it remotely, you know, secure shell and things like that. So I do that remotely.
So what would you like to tell us about, first of all, today? And I don't know if you want to tell us about today's story with an STL that you had just now arrived back from some kind of a quick fix. But what's a good story to start us off with about engineering in the trenches?
I'll bet you any engineer watching this could share stories like this. It's, you have some days where you have to drink coffee to stay awake, and then you'll have a day where you'll have two stations off there right in the middle of we're putting in a new data link. We're moving away from a company called Trango to one, Cambium, which you've probably heard of. And we're having trouble getting the link to talk. We've got a pretty good RSSI, a good signal, but they're still not talking. Well, right in the middle of both of my assistants, Todd and Jack, are at either end of that link. One of our stations here, the automation software, just decided to quit working. It just hung. Control room screen went blank. I happen to be here, so I get to go reboot the server and work on that, get them up. Fortunately, we have a very good board operator here midday that as soon as it happened, we only had like a few seconds of dead air, and he had already switched to a backup. So, but I said, well, it's just that kind of thing. And then the STL I was talking about, excuse me, while we're working on that new link, something happened. Come to find out, it was the Cisco switch up at our primary transmitter site, WDJC, up on Red Mountain. That's STL Nexus. We have a high-speed Dragon Wave link that carries everything over IP up to Red Mountain. And then from there, the tower looks like a dish farm, you know, sending signals out all over Alabama. So if you lose any one of those signals, you lose the station. If you lose the primary link, you lose several. And what had happened was that Cisco switch, there's something going on with it. I've got to go in and figure it. But for some reason, when we hooked up this new link, we had a couple of ports just quit working. Move them around, go in, play with the config a little bit, and everything's happy again. So that kind of stuff, you know, you run across things like that all the time.
So you mentioned a moment ago that you're replacing a Trango IP link, and Trango was a name that I came across a lot a few years ago. I don't so much anymore. I don't know much about that company. I never used one, but then you mentioned, I'm sorry. How do you pronounce it? Cambium?
Cambium. Link? Yes.
Yeah. And I know my good friend, he's been on the show before, Dave Anderson, is using a lot of Cambium links as well instead of Ubiquiti links. I guess he feels they're more along what the lines of what he needs. What was the reason for the change, and what are you finding with the Cambium? Well, you know, what's different in setting it up or getting it to work?
Excuse me. The problem with Trango and Dragon Wave is not that they don't work. They do, and they work fine. It mostly is in the area of support. And I've got to be careful what I say because I don't want to point fingers unjustly. But there's one of them that has kind of like skirted the red line a few times as far as revenues, financing. You know, in other words, they're in money trouble.
Yeah,
and I can't remember which of the two it is, and it's probably better if I don't. But Cambium, we feel like they're going to be more stable in that regard. They're a U.S. company, so we don't have to pay, foreign tariffs just to ship the thing to be repaired if it should need it. The main reason we went with Cambium, we talked to so many tower crews, and they had recommended it. They liked Cambium and Alcatel. They like Alcatel. Now, I like Ubiquiti too, for some of our links, especially the little short hops. They're amazing. The only thing you have to worry about with them, of course, the unlicensed ones, is interference. But we've been very fortunate in that respect so far. Knock on wood.
So tell me about this link where you've got a number of different stations, you know, your main link up to, you called it Red Mountain, I believe, right?
WDJC Red Mountain.
What is the nature of the audio going up there? Is it coded audio, or is it linear? How does it get in there and get to IP?
We have a kind of a collection. We have a couple of the Horizon, WorldCast Horizon units. We have a couple of tie lines. We have, believe it or not, I have a backup that's an old 950 megahertz link, an old Mosley, about 3,000 years old. You know, you have to light the pilot on it to lock up. But we're looking at expanding pure audio over IP from our network here. Just in other words, go ahead and make that truly a live, real-time member of our. We've discussed this before. You know, we use the Wheatstone.
Yeah.
But we have thought about putting a blade up there and transporting audio that way. But we're using kind of a mix.
And I know that there are WheatNet users that have done that. Of course, I've given examples of that using the LiveWire network, and still doing that in Mississippi. We've got four FMs going across about a 13-mile hop, unlicensed with Ubiquiti stuff. Have you, using your unlicensed stuff, your hops, have you ever run into interference that just popped up and then you had to make a frequency change on it?
Not that I'm aware of, because the only place we use, though, when I say short hop, that's like across a bass insulator at an AM something like that. The longest one I know of is like 500 feet. And the dishes are staring right at each other. So I hope we haven't had that interference trouble.
Hey, I want to ask Chris Tobin about this. Chris, I'm sure you've dealt with these different brands, Trango and Cambium and others, the Alcatel and the Ubiquiti. But, you know, I've always wondered, and I don't think I've asked you, Chris, in the New York City area, how much unlicensed stuff is going on? And is any unlicensed stuff used in broadcast chains?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, unlicensed spectrum is saturated here in the New York City area.
I'm sure.
The only saving grace is that the antennas that are being used by most of the people with their links have such a narrow beam width. You know, you're talking like 3 degrees at some. So you can have literally 5 or 6 people pointing in similar directions, and neither one of them interferes with each other. If you take the newer stuff, as Stephen pointed out with Ubiquiti for the unlicensed, Ubiquiti's newest algorithms and feature sets actually allow the units end-to-end, both far end, near end, to jump around and create, so to speak, how would I put it, frequency interference tolerance, I'll call it. You know, they tolerate the interference because they're able to move around and keep the data flowing. Now, remember, if you're doing live audio, say like LiveWire, WheatNet, or Ravenna, you got to make sure that you're doing a duplex chain, because the single units, like they say, the bullet series, those are high-speed switching, but they're not really duplex. It's like a semi-duplex approach.
Right.
So for data, for non-critical data, for certain things, you could use it without any issue because it's very fast and it works. But yeah, here I just put in a Ubiquiti link, 6 months ago, on top of a building to another building about 4.5 miles away. And oddly enough, it's working great. It replaced a previous 5.8 that was having issues. And the reason was not the radio, the electronics, the antenna they were using, which was about 8 years old. It was a pizza box, I'll call it that. You know, it's a rectangular flat panel. It's a active planar antenna. But if you looked at the spectrum, the waveform, the beam width, the pattern, the antenna pattern, it was just wide open to anything. It works great if you're out in the woods or if you're somewhere outside of an urban area. But in the city, it was just listening to everything on either side of it, even though it had a 30 dB front-to-back ratio. The side lobes were about 15 dB down. It wasn't even enough. As soon as we replaced the antenna, popped in a newer antenna with a tighter beam width, whoop, that was parabolic, actually. All of a sudden, the issues subsided. It was just literally changing the antenna. So I think, you know, Stephen's point with licensed, unlicensed, it's important to understand it's more than just the radio. It's the link, the distance of the link, whether it's from your base insulator to the, you know, the doghouse or the transmitter building, 500 feet, 300 feet, or if you're doing a 2 or 3 mile run, make sure that everything is factored in. The antennas, cables, you know, do the radios jump around? Like if you have Cambium or the Ruckus or Redline, I'm trying to think of the others, Dragon Wave, there's a few others. Any and all of these have the ability for tolerating frequency interference. They have the algorithms designed that way. Some of them are not turned on by default. Others are. So these are things to look into. And I know that because talking to the New York City wireless IP folks, they do the wireless for the city agencies, city government agencies. And one of my transmitter sites, they actually is co-located with them. So I've seen the equipment they use, how they program it, what they do. And I asked the questions. I said, so how do you guys minimize the interference issues with similar devices in the band? And they told me the reason they went with this particular brand is for the interference, tolerating interference with the algorithms. So these are things you have to think about and look at. So just don't assume I'm going to buy that $200 unit or say I'm going to spend $10,000 on a link because it's IP, it's this brand, this company. It's trouble-free. Ah, I've seen $10,000 systems fall apart real easy here in New York City because they weren't properly set up.
Yeah, interesting. And one thing that people ask me, and then I've preached, and I only know this kind of as an engineer layman. I mean, I'm not deep into the tech, but enough into it to kind of get an idea of what's going on. If you want to run a live, nearly unbuffered data stream and have it reliable 24/7, you generally have to turn off all the automatic stuff that's built into these radios. You know, the Ubiquiti radios have an amazing amount of stuff to keep you connected, but there's going to be little dropouts. There's going to be, you know, resends of packets at the radio level, and there's going to be, could be frequency switching. There could be all kinds of mitigation going on just to keep you talking. And that works great for file transfers and email and maybe even for a VoIP phone call. But if you want to send multi-megabits of LiveWire, WheatNet, AES-67, those things depend pretty much on having the equivalent of a piece of Cat 5e cable between the two places. So I wrote a paper on this where you've got to make sure that all this automatic mitigation is turned off and you're depending upon the raw data working very well. Now, that's my opinion because that's what I came across. That was what my experimentation showed, and it seemed to agree with what other industry experts said. I want to hear what Stephen Poole has to say about that. Of course, if you're running codecs, coded audio, then you do have typically more buffering, and you may be able to let those IP radios do their own mitigation, and which may not result in you know, always flowing packets. You may miss a few here or there, or get replaced here and there, but the codecs and their own stacks will make up for that. I'm sorry, Stephen, go ahead and give us your thoughts on that issue.
That's interesting. I'd like to ask Chris, how high that 4.5 mile hop you just set up, how high are the dishes? What's the elevation?
The elevation, let's see, on one end it's at 510 feet, about 510 feet above on top of a building, skyscraper. And the other end is about 180 feet above the ground. So, and there are two large buildings that are in the path on either side of the beam, if you will. So, you know, the Fresnel zone is far out there, so we were actually clearing it, but you were shooting between two buildings at mid-span.
You're threading the needle.
The needle.
Well, the reason I'm in is because we are limited by zoning and by what we're stuck with here. We have a nano bridge, as a matter of fact. Now, it's an older one, and we're planning on replacing it with one of the better ones, one of the new ones. But our problem is it's really only about 70 or 80 feet above an apartment complex right next to us. And, of course, that apartment complex is a jungle of wireless signals. And so we only use that in dire emergencies. That would be about a 4.7-mile hop that would back up our primary Dragon wavelength. My personal opinion, Kirk's right. With codecs, you can set some buffering. You sacrifice a little bit of your real-time sound, but you can increase your buffering a little bit to help cover glitches and frequency hopping and other techniques that are used. When we do toss a blade up there, or if we were to go with some of the TELUS equipment, whichever we use, my personal opinion is we're going to use a licensed, dedicated link that nobody else can touch. That's just my personal opinion. I think it's more reliable without cursing Ubiquiti in any way, because they make some amazing stuff for some amazing prices.
Yeah.
I would agree with you on that. I would agree with you. Just bear in mind, from what I've found out talking to some folks who do this kind of work for a living, and I know from personal experience for the last 30 years, just remember, for those of you watching and listening, just because it's a licensed band doesn't mean you're immune to interference. It just gives you the right to chase after the people causing the problem much easier.
Yes.
Because I worked with a team, an RF engineering company, about 3 years ago here in New York City, chasing after an issue with a licensed link. And that's how I discovered this, talking to the RF engineer, the applications guy from the manufacturer. He says, look, here's what it is, real basic. You're licensed, you have a right to go after them, and you can prove it. You're unlicensed, you basically have to do a street fight or, you know, negotiate somehow and say, I know a guy. Either stop it or I know a guy. That's in very simplest terms. I kid you not, okay? And I know there are people out there listening right now going, yeah, actually, you're right, but I'll never admit to it in public. That's the reality. And yes, I work here in New York City, and you can watch all the different movies. You can know all the different stories. This is the way it works, okay? I know a guy. Let's take care of the problem. Or they call. And I say this because many, 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 many years ago, Judd Mansbeck, who is former FCC inspector here in New York City, who's retired many years, came to us, the broadcast group, in an SBE meeting one night. And we all sat there going, well, it's nice of you to come and talk about the FCC and enforcement. This is when there was enforcement. This is when there was actual common sense. And he said to everyone in the room, he goes, look, let's all be honest amongst each other here. I know this is being recorded, so I'm going to be straightforward. It's real simple. I know who's speeding and who's not. And I know why you're speeding. I understand the marketplace and I understand the dollars involved. All I ask is, if you're going to speed, can you all agree to speed the same pace? And now when I say speeding, I mean modulation of your carrier. Okay? And that was it. And he said, look, I'm more than happy to come out and give you grief, but it's too much paperwork for me. It's not worth it. But if you're going to tattletale on your competitor because they're speeding, and I know that you are, that's where we draw the line. That's when it comes to an end. Then everybody falls down. And I'll take that. And I'll remember that every time I work with anyone on a project. I say, look, don't you start going crazy. Just because they're doing that doesn't mean you have the right to go and yell. Don't throw that stone in the glass house. You're not the only one around. But I'm just saying, these are the things you have to factor in when you're building a link. And Steve's right. I've got a backup link, Nano Bridge, excellent product. I've used several of them for small hops, and they work well. They use TDMA technology and their MIMO antennas. So it gives you a little bit of robustness, more than a single antenna. But for mission critical, and at the end of the day, if my revenue stream is involved, I'm going to go license. This way, at least I have a little protection and say, okay, this is good. There's less chance of people bothering me, and I can at least see who's out there. Makes total sense.
But you are absolutely right. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
So we got to take a quick break and remind our listeners and viewers, you're listening or watching to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 430. It's a war stories episode, although we're kind of talking about solving problems right now in real time. But coming up on the second part of our show, I really want to hear from Stephen about some of his latest exploits, including the tale of the famous 3,000 year old generator. So maybe he's got something else, but that sure piqued my interest. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store. And BGS represents almost every manufacturer you can think of. And one of those manufacturers is Henry Engineering and the Henry Sportscaster. Now, the Henry Sportscaster is so cool. If you do sports broadcasting, you need the Henry Sportscaster. It's a sports broadcast audio control system, but it's not just a mic mixer. It's a lot more than that. The list of things that it does is just amazing. But you know what? You can put this all into a little case, take it out to a ball game, and do a really professional show. It does talent headphone audio distribution, so it handles that for you. It does talkback intercom mic for the producer. It does duplex intercom between the producer and the talent. They can talk both ways when you add these little talent modules. It does producer headphone audio mixing. It does headphone mix for the field reporter and the camera operators. Hey, you know, that's a big thing now, putting these high school and college ball games on cable TV or on the internet, streaming there. It has a field reporter headphone output, so your field reporter can be fed just the right thing, including IFB. It has a camera operator headphone output. It's got a party line intercom between the producer, the talent, and the field reporter. You know, it sounds like I'm talking about an intercom system here, but no. This is the whole kit and caboodle. It's the Sportscaster from Henry Engineering. A couple more features. Of course, it's got the main program audio output to air or to streaming. It has inputs for the crowd mic and for a PA announcer. I mean, it's got all this stuff. And it's just amazing what you can do with this thing. It handles three sports pods. That's the name for the module that goes in front of the sports talent. They can mute themselves. They can adjust their volume. They can, turn their mic on and off. It's got a field reporter input, two aux inputs, a local input, and a return input. And then all kinds of outputs, all the stuff you need, a program on an XLR. Program on a 3.5 millimeter tip ring sleeve. It's got field and camera outputs, link IO, headphones, so much stuff, all built into a one rack unit box. So you would put this in front of a producer, a control operator, or a really talented announcer at your remote site, whether you're doing a parade, a basketball game, coming up on baseball season, coming up, you do those, you have a color, you have a spotter, as well as your announcer. This is a really great solution. It's the Henry Sportscaster. Now, if you want to get pricing on this, find out about it, including when you can get your hands on one, well, just contact Broadcasters General Store. Their phone number, 352-622-7700. The easy thing, though, is their website, BGS, as in Broadcasters General Store, bgs.cc. And you'll get there. You'll see their phone number, and you can, you know, get pricing right online there, or you can give them a call. I tell you, they are just great with the phones. Have you been? I'm guessing that most people have never been to their offices. They have the most amazing setup. It's comfortable for the people who work there, and they have all the information they need spread out like on three monitors in front of every single person who works there. So whether you talk to Carrie there, or whether you talk to Jessica or Dave or Chris or Hugh, anybody at Broadcaster General Store, you're gonna have a good time. So give them a call at 352-622-7700 and check out that Henry Sportscaster, an amazing box. All right. This week in Radio Tech, episode 430, War Stories. And now I really want to hear a war story. Stephen, is there anything to this 3,000-year-old generator?
Well, I'll put it to you this way. It's a Kato light. And the station who owned, the people who owned that station before us had bought it used. Oh. So I'm not sure the age of it, but it's, well, it's got about 800 run hours on it.
Okay.
And that's actually a lot for a generator.
Yeah,
and the muffler on it had completely rusted, and we were afraid water was getting down in, you know, down into the turbocharger. We've got another muffler coming. The tech said he had to order it, which I have to take his word for it. I would have gone to AutoZone and bought one, but he says they've got to order one. So I put a piece of stovepipe over it. I wish there was some way I could show you a picture on the phone. I've got one on Facebook. And hose clamped it. We cannot do engineering without hose clamps. You are aware of this.
Duct tape, that's a good point.
Hose clamp.
Yeah.
WD-40. Got to have them in the toolkit. And by the way, Kirk, not to change the subject, I hope you were not as frightened as I was at the way that Tobin said, "Hey, I know a guy." I mean, that, you know, I felt a chill, you know?
it comes with its territory up there. It certainly does. And the culture.
But so, what did we do? Go ahead. By the way, folks viewing, there is about a 2-second delay here, and I apologize if it sounds like I'm talking over Kirk. I apologize. There's a 2-second delay on this link for some reason.
It happens every time. If I could do the show from the GFQ studios in New York, then we'd have half the delay. But since we're all remote, we all hear the full delay of two way. It would work better if the host of the show, and you know what? Maybe sometime Chris should just host the show and be at the GFQ studio, you know, at the big command center there. And then we'd have shorter delay, but we deal with it. It's okay. People understand. So what did this generator do? I mean, did it just fail at an inopportune time?
Well, like I said, the reason I wanted to, cover the muffler was to keep water out of the turbocharger.
Oh, yeah.
And because the way, it's a typical generator. The, oh, goodness, I'm good at this. the muffler is mounted to the top of the cabinet, and then right. You have a pipe that comes straight down to the exhaust equipment on that generator, the turbocharger system and all that, exhaust manifold. And I was afraid we'd have water running down in there. But now before then, we had to replace a battery. And that's something else. I don't know if you guys have run across. It kind of amazes me the way modern batteries now, they seem to be a lot better and they last a lot longer. But when they're ready to die, they die. Because I know there was, in fact, in my car, just to give you an idea, this was a Ford Fusion that I had a couple of years ago. Yeah, something happened to it. It broke. I have the extended warranty. So they came and towed it to the nearest dealer. By the time they had, and I had cranked it and everything was fine. By the time they got it to the dealer, put it up on the rack and then tried to start diagnosing, they said, your battery's bad. The voltage is too low. And I said, you're kidding me. It just cranked. And that's the way this generator did. We had had a lot of storms that had kind of knocked it off and we had a little brief power outages. So I think that kind of just wore it out. Now, today's joy was that the high temperature sensor had shorted, so the controller wouldn't let the generator crank. That's what we had to do today. It's an old generator. It still cranks out voltage, but it's old.
You bring up a good point about battery, and I want to see what Chris Tobin's experience is, but on at least for car batteries, my experience has in the last 10 years, or even maybe the last 5 years, has mimicked what you just said. The batteries used to give you a lot of warning. It's cranking kind of slow, so I'll need to replace the battery in the next week or two or three or a month. And when it gets really bad, then you go replace the battery. But it seems like nowadays, however they're making modern batteries, and I bet they're putting the plates closer together and getting more advertised cranking amps out of them. And then so things are closer together and shorts can happen more quickly and easily. But yeah, I've noticed this. You might get one bad crank out of the whole thing, like, but then the next time it's dead, it's gone. It won't take a charge. Chris, what's been your experience with big batteries like that?
When I have had mine fail on one generator many, many years ago, it just split open, actually.
It
was pretty wild. That was pretty good. Well, I discovered over the years, and I've worked with a few generator companies to learn a little more about the battery technologies and what's the best way to approach something like a genset that sits idle, 90% of the time. So you sort of have to do a lot of preventive maintenance, but on various levels. So like we had one place I worked at, we had a diesel, a Cummins diesel, and it was a very nice engine. It was 100 kilowatt. And the generator service guy who's doing this for 50 years, he was in the army, the whole bit. He explained to me, he goes, look, the one thing you need to do is run the generator on the load. Yes, I'm aware of that. I get that. I understand why. Perfect. He goes, however, what you need to do is check the battery resistance on your battery to measure its life. If you don't measure that, it may look like everything is fine until the day you start to use it and the resistance has changed and now it's overcharging. It'll die. I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. Okay, so you put the battery under load. Okay, so I started doing that with service companies. I said, okay, I'm going to have a service contract. I want to make sure you can check the battery life and what methods you use. And that's what I've been doing. So I've been able to forestall any crazy battery outages because of not looking at that. And then I started looking at the block heaters for diesel, checking in the fuel, putting the fuel tanks in a place that's somewhat environmentally controlled if possible, looking at local zoning for that too. Today's battery technology has increased considerably. It's not like it used to be where you open it up and go, oh, got to get some distilled water. Let me check the pH, the that little bubble, specific gravity.
Specific gravity.
Yeah. Like that dates me there right there. If anyone was like, what? Specific gravity of battery? Yes, don't worry. It's not going to fly out of the car. That's why it's strapped in because of gravity. Never mind. I'm only kidding. That's for those that don't have any idea what we're talking about with generators of the day. But, because you got light bulb batteries today and all this other stuff that doesn't require any maintenance. It's literally, is it working? Is it getting charged properly? That's the other thing, charging. A lot of folks, years ago, the charges in some of these generators was really not a delta charge, meaning that it didn't look at the resistance as the current draw changed. It just pumped out certain number of amps, milliamps, and just kept going. So when the battery is fully charged, it cooked it. As the old saying goes, you cook the battery. You open up, it's, oh, look, the lead cells are dry. There's a reason for that. The newer technologies, the newer generators. But I worked at a place, you know, we're talking war stories, so I'll throw this in. I had just taken a job at a station, and we wound up going on generator because there was a power outage from a car accident near the road. Our transmitter site was near the expressway. So unfortunately, somebody, you know, veered off the road, hit a pole. Thankfully, they were okay, but the pole took out several other poles. And as we all know, that means you're on generator for some time. We were on generator for some time. And then suddenly we were on no generator for any time. Turns out that the previous engineering people decided to replace the battery and the alternator rather than contact the generator company. They did it themselves. So here's what they did. Because when I had the guy come in and take a look at what happened, the other thing was the wiring harness that you see wrapped around your generator for everything that makes it work was totally melted. So I had to we had to replace the harness, the alternator, a few other things. Anything electrical on the generator had to be replaced. Wow. Turns out they decided because it was a Ford engine, six-cylinder Ford engine, they went and got a Ford alternator and a Ford battery for the Ford engine that's used in the car. The difference is they do a little change modification for the loading for various other reasons. So it's not really the same Ford engine you found in that Ford car. It's a bit modified. There's different changes. I'm not going to go into the details. Anyone who's a mechanic knows exactly what I'm talking about. And that's what happened. Generator ran for several hours and under load, and all of a sudden the alternator started to have a problem. And before you know it, the diodes in the alternator went bad. And before you know it, the battery tried to do something, and it blew up nicely. Thank goodness the concrete room that the generator was in prevented anything from spreading. It was a mess. So that was another lesson learned. So whenever I take over a place where I'm called in for a contract worker and say, can you maintain our transmitter site or just be available? First thing I look at is, do you have backup power? Yes. What method are you using? Okay, can you show me the most recent log from your PM visit? And when they look at you and go, PM visit? Okay, we need to sit down and talk. So there's the generator story, history, and my experience, and a war story all in one.
Wow, good deal. Steven, you got any more generator advice for us before we move on?
No, Chris pretty well covered it. I've certainly gone to Walmart and bought auto batteries in an emergency, but yes, I've replaced them later. I just go with we use a technician now who lives up near that transmitter, and he can get there in a few minutes unless he's tied up, and we pretty much let him handle the maintenance now, thank the Lord. If you're not comfortable working on diesels, you really need to use a good technician. What you take away from Chris's story, and this is true, don't go to NAPA or AutoZone and start buying regular car parts and putting them on a generator because you won't enjoy what happens. Now, he's right about that. Now, those of you who do know diesels, and I'm not one of them, I'm not a diesel mechanic. Those of you who do know diesels, you can probably do all kinds of magic with them. My brother-in-law, I told you I'm tired. My father-in-law, now he is a mechanic, and I would trust him to do anything on that generator. I'm not. I fix transmitters. I fix stuff like this. Isn't that pretty?
What is that? Can't quite see it.
You don't recognize the high voltage multiplier from a old tube transmitter. That was a few years ago. That melted a big hole in the cabinet. We had to go patch it. Now there's a war story for you. So that was a BE-FM30.
I was going to ask, do you still have some tube transmitters that are on the air?
Thank the Lord. Knock on wood. And thank you, Mr. Crawford and my boss, Chris. We are all solid state now. We do still have a couple of BEs as auxiliaries, tubes. We're getting rid of our last tube auxiliary. It's an old, at our 5 kilowatt AM, it's an old Continental 315. The old 315, the one with the, had something like 7 zillion volts on the modulator tube.
That's a classic. That's a classic.
Beautiful train. Yeah, and you've never lived until you see the filament transformer on that modulator tube go short. It is just spectacular because they have a little glass window in the front. You know, and it looks like there's a demon running around inside your transmitter. You see smoke, fire. It's lovely.
So Chris, I got a question before we have to take our last break. And the Crawford Broadcasting always impresses me as a very no-nonsense broadcaster. You guys have a number of good clusters across the country. You've got terrific engineers at these clusters. You've got a great leader in Chris Alexander. Yes. I read about the things that you guys do, and I see some of it, and it just looks like you do things right and you do things reasonably. If you can't speak to this, or if there's nothing to speak about, that's fine. But I'm wondering, you know, what emphasis are the engineers at Crawford Broadcasting, what emphasis are they looking at now? What's important, or what's coming down the pike, or what's Chris Alexander messaging to you guys about what we need to be paying attention to right now as we get into 2019? What's important now?
I don't think we could say there's any one thing, but go ahead, Chris. He said Chris and Crawford. I assumed he wanted me, but
Oh, I have a question for you, for Steve, along the same lines. I'm curious because I know Chris Alexander, we've talked with him, and I've met him several times at NAB, and I've met many folks like yourself in the Crawford organization over the years. I'm curious because from what I can see and the way you guys operate, how involved are the engineers at the local stations with the management, like say program directors, marketing department, maybe finance, the other areas, news operations, if there are any, how involved are you as far as learning from them, talking, listening, asking questions? Are you involved in any of the meetings they have from time to time, or planning, or strategic planning? I'll use that phrase. That seems to be a popular thing. I'm just curious if you can speak on that.
That's a tough question to answer because it depends on the circumstances, depends on the station. Yes, we have a good relationship. Nowadays, we tend to do more communicating with email and things like that than we do with actual face-to-face meetings. But they know.
That's okay.
Management knows that if they need anything, all they have to do is ask us. And we work. Bend over backwards to give them what they need to make the station successful. And Chris's attitude, I guess, excuse me, if I had to put it, Chris Alexander's attitude is our jobs is not to be showy, but to keep everything 100% working so that the management and the sales and programming can do their jobs. Does that make any sense to you? In other words,
that is exactly the answer I was looking for.
Yeah, that's our attitude. It's like, I know, in fact, I had one guy tell me a few weeks ago, he says, you know, you're hardly ever here. And I said, well, we've had a lot of storms. I'm at transmitter sites, covered with mud, trying not to get stuck, working on transmitters, working on towers. Lots of lightning damage, things like that. The reason you don't know about it is because we do have auxiliaries and backups. You might have noticed, we popped off the air for a couple of minutes the other day. That's how long it took for the backup to kick in. But I said, our job is to keep you on the air sounding good so that you can sell it, make money, and program it.
Yep. That's exactly what I was expecting. Yeah, no, that's perfect. That's exactly what I've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah.
Guys, we're talking to Stephen Poole and Chris Tobin here. Yeah, we got a lot of delay, but it's okay. We'll suffer through it anyway. Hey, coming up, we've got a couple of tips of the week coming up for you. I don't think I warned Stephen about this, but Stephen, I'm looking for a word of wisdom, a tip of the week, a good takeaway from your perspective. What advice would you give other engineers? And I know you're an educator too. So what advice would you give other engineers coming up after this break? Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Lavo. We'll be right back.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the Jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. And if you use that URL, lavo.com/twert, it'll take you right to their radio products, and also to let them know that that you went there because we asked you to and you're interested. Appreciate that very much. All right. It's This Week in Radio Tech, episode 430. We're down to the wire here on just a couple of tips we're going to give you. I'm going to start with a tip because I saw this actually, you know, we love and hate Facebook, right? Alex Hartman posted on Facebook a screen capture of a transmitter site about a week ago when we had all that snow and that storm that came through much of the U.S., a transmitter site where the door had either broken or blown in and snow everywhere inside the transmitter building. And the picture was taken with, you know, I'm always looking for cheap, affordable webcams that do a lot. Well, this one right here may be a good choice. Now, you know, this is not got the performance of a, you know, a $200 webcam because it's a $20 webcam. It's made by Wyze, W-Y-Z-E. It has an app, and the app is okay. You can put your own there's me live right here showing you the Wyze app. And of course, I think that the live, you know, you can look at this live from anywhere, and that's free from Wyze. I think that's a free service. You can, you know, put a memory card in the camera, and then you can access that remotely. Wyze doesn't offer storage in the cloud, or at least not for free. I'm not sure about all that. But anyway, it's working good for me, and you can get – there's all kinds of accessories you can get for this. You can get outdoor housings, for example. Now, it's Wi-Fi only, and the connection is maybe a little tenuous. It's got to have power, so it's a micro USB connection. So you've got to run micro USB power out to it wherever it is. But I'm trying this guy out. It seems reasonable. It seems, you know, better than any other $20 camera. Supposedly it's 1080 and, it's pretty decent. So anyway, Wyze, W-Y-Z-E, you can buy them on Amazon, but you can also go to the website where they're showing this same camera here for $20. It comes with a few accessories to mount it. It's on a little stand right here, but it also has a magnet on the bottom of it. So you can mount this piece of metal with this adhesive, circle, to, you know, a surface, and then just clamp it on there with the magnetic mount. So anyway, it seems like it might be a cool, interesting, and inexpensive solution where you need a camera and you don't want to spend more than $20. That's my tip. Chris Tobin, how about you? You got a tip for us this week?
Yeah. Actually, I have a couple of them. One is recently doing a project, actually working on a project right now with equipment racks at a remote location that I don't have. It's not secure, meaning that it's a shared space. Something to consider, very important if you're a transmitter for a site that, say, you don't have rooms with walls. It's just a bunch of racks, rows of racks, and you have to secure your rack accordingly. Consider, and bear in mind, people don't always think of this, putting a magnetic switch, a magnet monitor on those doors. So when you open up the rack door, your remote control senses it and sends you a message saying, hey, your rack has just been opened up. I say this because I'm working at a place where the equipment we're putting into the rack and the communications going through the rack require a certain level of security. And that's all I can say. So access to the rack has to be monitored at all levels, literally all four doors, the top, the side panels have buttons on them. I mean, everything. You pop anything on this rack, and there's going to be a very busy moment for you. that's one tip. And it's handy, because I've been to a couple of transmitter sites where people do that just for safety's sake. So this way, if they're out there by themselves or doing stuff, if an alarm occurs, the studio calls and says, "Hey, are you guys out there?" And they're like, "Yeah, we are." "Okay, great, thank you." You know, it's important to understand that. And the other thing I want to share with everyone is this. This is a mug, right? It says here. It's called Simple Modern. It's a 12-ounce Scout, as you can see. It's one of these thermal extruded aluminum doodads. And it has the little top on it, you know, and stuff. I will tell you that I place coffee in this at 9 o'clock in the morning, and by 11 a.m., almost noon, it's still hot. So I'm going to be working overnight tonight. This is coming with me. I'm going to put some coffee in it, and I can get through halfway through the night with this. It really works well. SimpleModern.com. And I just have to say, I know many of us probably get the usual paper cup coffee or whatever, and it's, you know, cold by the time you get to the transmitter. This guy really holds up. It really is cool. They come in 18 ounce as well if you really are, you know, want to do more. Check it out.
I got a question. Why would you not drink the coffee in 3 hours time? Anyway, if I get a cup of coffee, I'm going to drink the coffee.
I can tell you, working at a couple of sites with activity going on, you put your coffee down, you're testing. Like I was I was tuning up some cavities for a duplexer, and I'm sitting there doing return loss, blah, 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 blah. And before I know, I was like, oh, goodness, it's been 2 hours. Oh, no. So this guy, it saves me. It's going to be saving me tonight. That's how that works for me. I mean, maybe I'm the only one, but I know I've worked with a lot of folks. I see coffee cups at a couple of sites that are there, and you go like, that's half full. I know what happened to that guy. All right, I get it.
All right, Stephen, you got a word of wisdom you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, the biggest one, this is going to sound kind of corny, and others have said it. The biggest thing I would say to anyone in this business, never stop learning. I started out years and years ago when there was nothing but tubes. Well, there was a few solid state, including some wonderful gate stuff that we won't get into. But basically, never stop learning. I mean, now I'm basically the equivalent of a system administrator, an IT professional, and a whole lot of other things. And most importantly of all, I know a guy.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Make sure you know a guy. That's good advice. Make sure you know a guy.
Hey, I know a guy.
Hey, guys, this has been fun, but we got to go. I do have one last piece of advice, and you may think this is slightly uncouth, but I swear to you, this is important. Never, never take X-Lax or Milk of Magnesia on the way to the transmitter site. You need to wait. You need to wait until.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Most sites don't have any facilities. You will be sorry.
Really?
If you. Yeah. Don't ask me how I know that. Don't ask me how I know that.
We won't.
We got to go. It's been fun. And Stephen Poole, the chief engineer in Birmingham for Crawford Broadcasting, has been our guest. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us. Sure do appreciate you spending an hour with us. Thank you very much.
Had a ball. Thank you.
All right. Hey, coming up next week on This Week in Radio Tech, our guest is going to be Don Mussel. He is an engineer. He lives on the island of Kauai. His reputation is everywhere, and he's a pretty good guy and full of great advice. He's one of these guys that gets to go to all these Hawaii mountaintop sites. And we'll see if we can share some pictures, too, from Don Mussel in Hawaii. I want to thank Suncast, our producer of This Week in Radio Tech. Of course, I want to thank Chris Tobin, our co-host. And again, thanks to Stephen Poole for joining us for an hour, despite the fact that he barely made it back to his office after handling an STL issue this afternoon. I called him from the SBE meeting today. Hey, Steve, you going to join us? He said, you know, I'm 75 miles away right now, or something like that. So anyway, I'm glad he was able to get over here and join us. Thanks also to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. We got to go. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.